Hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we are on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And before I go on, let me say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guests, and not those of the University of California Regents. Today, my guests are Leslie Hazelton and Janice Halliwell. First up is Leslie Hazelton. Leslie's books include Israeli Women, Where Mountains Roar, and the award-winning Jerusalem, Jerusalem. Her Middle East reporting has appeared in Time magazine, The New York Times, Esquire, Vanity Fair, The Nation, The New Republic, and The New York Review of Books. Born in England, she lived in Jerusalem for 13 years, in New York for another 13, and now lives on a houseboat in downtown Seattle. Her most recent book is Mary, published by Bloomsbury. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. What an evocative, lovely book you have written. Mary, a flesh and blood biography of the Virgin Mother. Will you talk about how this project came about?
Oh, it was like, basically it was a gift to me in many, many ways. It was literally a gift. I was at a party, I was at a stage in my life where I was wondering, as writers sometimes do, what am I going to do when I grow up? In other words, what am I going to do next? And a friend, well, not quite a friend, but more than an acquaintance, came up to me and said, Leslie, I have the most perfect book for you to write. She knew a little bit about me. She knew that I was Jewish, that I'd been brought up in a convent school. She knew that I'd spent many, many years living in Jerusalem. And I said, usually, you know, if someone says that to a writer, they'll say, well, you know, keep it to yourself. you must write it yourself. Don't tell me writers steal ideas and so on. But I really like Teresa. She's, as you can probably guess from her name, a lapsed Catholic. And along with Graham Greene, I think sometimes there's no truer Catholic than a lapsed Catholic, one who's always wrestling with the faith.
Yes.
And so I said, okay, sit down, tell me. And she leaned forward with this light in her eyes and said, a biography of Mary. That's it, just those four words. And I said, as in virgin, just to make sure. She said, yes. And she said, and I said, you mean as she really was, as she must have been, the real woman? She said, yes, yes, yes. And what can I tell you? It was like fireworks going off in my brain. I mean, I live here on a lake in Seattle where about 200 yards from the barge where they let off the fireworks each 4th of July. And it was like that. It was like fireworks within fireworks within fireworks, and I instantly knew I absolutely had to do this book. And because I knew that I absolutely had to do it and nothing on earth was going to stop me, I spent the next 2 hours trying as hard as I possibly could to persuade her to write it herself. She's a journalist. Because I knew that something like this was so immense a gift, it could only be given in absolute good faith, that if she ever had a moment's regret about it, it would somehow, not exactly curse the whole project, but it would mar it. And it had to be pure good faith. And she just kept on insisting, no, I don't want to write it. I want to read it, and I want to read it written by you.
So,
what a gift. I mean, not only the gift of the book itself, but it was just, it was like it was giving me back to myself. Everything that I've always been interested in, matters of religion, even though I'm not formally religious myself, the Middle East, all my Middle East experience and living there, the Catholic, you know, the Jewish girl in a Catholic convent childhood and so on. It was like a gift of my whole life to me.
Yes. Well, then how does one do a biography of someone like Mary, someone that there's very little known and, you know, very little to go on?
Immensely little. So little, in fact, that there's more in the Quran about Mary than there is in the whole of the New Testament.
Interesting.
Yeah. So little that a scene we all think we know for sure happened, that is Mary standing at the foot of the cross at the crucifixion, does not even occur in the first three of the Gospels in the New Testament. Only occurs in the last one to be written in John. And even then, she's not even called by her name. She's just his mother.
Yes.
It's kind of, it's shocking. I mean, clearly this is not the kind of biography that, you know, that starts Mary of Nazareth was born on such and such a date and such a street and so on. It's an exploration of who Mary was, who she must have been in her time and in her place in first century Palestine, living in Nazareth, a tiny village of 200 to 300 people. What she knew, what she saw, what she experienced, what she did. And the picture that emerges is just amazing.
You have such an incredible bibliography. I imagine that you found so many bits and pieces here and there, I mean, as your bibliography would indicate.
Well, in fact, I feel like it took 4 years of very intensive research, what I call 18-hour library days, one after the other after the other, plus, of course, going back to the Middle East. I feel like I got about 6 doctorates in those 4 years simultaneously, in history, in theology, in anthropology was especially useful, mythology, Middle East studies, of course. I was amazed how much Aramaic I could make out. It's not a language spoken anymore, but because I speak fluent Hebrew and some Arabic, I had enough to get me through and so on. And basically reconstructing her, I felt like I was sort of bringing her back to life, you know, and letting her step out of that niche and, you know, that statue that's, step out from behind the statue that's in those niches in the walls or in the sort of gardens and so on, and walk into herself.
Yes.
You know, a real, live, flesh and blood woman.
Hmm. If you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing, and I am here today with Leslie Hazelton, author of Mary, a Flesh and Blood Biography of the Virgin Mother, published by Bloomsbury. Bloomsbury seems to me to be such an interesting press. The material they published, they publish and continue to publish. How did you come in contact with them?
Well, through my agent, but of course, you know, I love it because Bloomsbury, of course, was, you know, brings to mind Virginia Woolf and so on.
Yes.
And there's a wonderful quote in here somewhere, which I can't find right now, of Virginia Woolf saying, and exaggerating, as she tended to do, that she can't imagine why everybody tries to write, you know, biographies and giving someone just one cohesive life, when in fact, she said, we all have hundreds of lives that are all sort of, you know, all hundreds of strands in our lives that are all woven together. Well, you know, I don't know about hundreds, but she does have a point that our lives are far more complex. They don't follow straight linear developments the way many biographies show. And this one, partly for that reason, doesn't. It really does explore what if this and what if that, and especially, of course, when it comes to how she got pregnant. But it does start, it is always based in the reality of first century Palestine, to the extent that her name, for instance, one of the first things I did was insist that we call her by her real name, which is not Mary, because English, of course, didn't even exist as a language 2,000 mm-hmm. years ago, but in Aramaic, which is the language she spoke, her name is Mariam.
Mm-hmm.
And Mariam is the name she knew as her own. And it seemed to me that it was the most elementary respect we could give her was to call her by her real name. And this was one of the things I knew from the start. I knew her. I knew she was called Mariam. I knew what she looked like, which was not at all like the statues, of course. She was Middle Eastern. She was dark. She was short, hard-muscled, wiry. I knew what she ate. I knew what she drank. I knew the feel of thorns and rocks in her feet, from her sandals on that kind of ground in the Galilee. I knew the feel of dust in her nostrils and her ears and her eyes and so on. I knew the quality of the air and the light at dawn. So because I lived there so long, I could sort of combine and sort of step into her shoes to some extent.
Interesting. Will you read to us?
It's like asking a writer to write, please. I'll read a little bit from the very end of the introduction, and I should introduce it by saying that I said the project, it took me 4 years to write this book, full-time, I mean double full-time. But about 6 months into the research, I finally realized how huge an undertaking I'd taken on myself. And that's when I had a fit of major trepidation, which was not helped by friends' reactions. They were sort of, they were leery or wary of this whole idea. They were sort of like, it was almost as though I shouldn't touch Mary, that somehow I would make her less by looking at her and trying to ask who she was, who she really was as a real flesh and blood woman, to which, of course, now I can say, oh, ye of little faith, right?
Yes.
But, you know, it occurred to me about 6 months in, the question that came to me was, how dare you, how dare you do this?
Really?
So this, yeah, I mean, I've just, you know, the immensity of this undertaking sort of suddenly hit me. And I had to get over that, of course, in order to continue. So here's what I wrote about that. The picture that develops in this book is of another woman altogether from the one I grew up with, surrounded as I was by images of her in the convent school. Statues in the corridors, portraits on holy cards, the ever-present rosaries, hymns, invocations. I grew up, that is, with an anodyne, alabaster image. She was always in the same pose, standing with arms slightly outstretched, eyes downcast, mantle falling from head to shoulders to wrists. A modest Mary, never shown pregnant, let alone nursing her child. So modest that in what now seems a cruel stroke of irony, the convent was named not for her, but for her husband, St. Joseph's. I took her for granted, as children do. She was simply there. I heard stories of her appearing to children at Lourdes and other places, and one day I even sneaked into the convent chapel to see if the life-size statue of her there would talk to me. But I realized quickly that it wouldn't. Not to me. The Hebrew girl, as they called me. It didn't occur to me then that she, too, was a Hebrew girl. And this may be the answer to the question, how dare I? Perhaps my own biography is what gives me license. As a Jew who once seriously considered becoming a rabbi, as a former convent schoolgirl who daydreamed about being a nun, as an agnostic with a deep sense of religious mystery, if no affinity for organized religion, or perhaps I take my license as a woman for whom there is no heroism in being meek and mild, or as a psychologist seeking understanding, or as a journalist looking for the real story. But if I had to point to one single motivating factor, it would be the old Kabbalistic ideal of tikkun olam, repairing the world. This is what I want, to repair the world of Mary and weave it anew into whole cloth, to give her back to herself, starting with her real name, Mariam, to restore her strength and her intelligence and see her as the multifaceted human being she was before she became an icon. Peasant, healer, nationalist, mother, teacher, leader, and yes, virgin, though in a sense we've long forgotten. It occurs to me now that perhaps this book is my way of finding that Mary did speak to me after all. Not the gilded image in the convent school, but the wiry, dark-skinned, hard-muscled Mariam, barely out of adolescence when she gave birth, her face lined by hard work and harder experience, etched deep by violence and struggle, survival and loss, determination and courage. There is nothing meek and mild about Mariam. She is neither pale nor passive. In fact, she emerges as far more than we've yet accepted her as being, a strong woman of ability and wisdom who actively chose her role in history and lived it to the fullest.
Thank you very much. That was Leslie Hazelton reading from Mary, a flesh and blood biography of the Virgin Mother, published by Bloomsbury. Gosh, the writing is so lovely in this book, so literary and crafted. Was it that way from the start, or is there a draft during which you go over and are really just working on tone and voice and getting the words right, where that's more of what that draft is about?
Oh, what a superb question. I have no idea how many drafts there were. But there were a lot, because the struggle from the very beginning was for the tone, the voice. I wanted to write this biography of Mary out of respect. I wanted to do honor to her. As a woman, as a real woman, it had to be done with respect for her humanity. And It was very, the tone, as you say, was hard won. And in fact, the book is written in three, I guess there's three different styles which are sort of woven together. The one that's caused most controversy and that I've been criticized for is most of the chapters start with a small section that's from Maryam's point of view, which is obviously fiction, even though everything that's in there, every single detail, is the result of factual research. And I've been attacked for this as not as heretical, but as sort of disturbing the non-fiction flow, even though they're quite set apart. I would do it again in a heartbeat, because the reason I did it was a very good reason. I wanted to make her real. I wanted to let the reader see her. I wanted her to be a real, living, breathing, flesh and blood presence.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other two voices, one is the usual non-fictional, sort of more authoritative voice. You know, I believe everything I say. And the third one is a much more personal non-fiction voice, which was also, to me, very, very helpful, because so much of this is comes out of my own experience in the Middle East. I see it very much as a Middle Eastern book about a Middle Eastern woman. And I was particularly lucky in that I arrived there in the 60s just before the whole of the traditional peasant way of life began to fall apart with the introduction of electricity and hot and cold running water and all those things we take for granted in the West. But most peasant societies didn't even know until the second half of the last century, of the 20th century. And in fact, throughout the world, a whole way of life disappeared in the last 50 years. But I could see it. I could see it just before it began to disappear. You could literally sit on a hillside of terraced stone walls and watch somebody plowing with a single prong plow pulled by a mule and think, this is just like biblical times. And it is. It was just like biblical times. It hadn't changed. An immensely stable way of life that has now almost completely disappeared.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, something you said a little earlier about the beginning parts that are fictional from her point of view. Mm-hmm. How, in terms of writing biography, how much do you get to embellish? How much do you get to fictionalize when there's very little, especially when there's very little known about the person you're writing about? I mean, how much license do you get as a biographer, really?
That depends on the biographer. There are some biographers. Funny, I was on a panel
at the LA Times.
Yes, the LA Times panel in Los Angeles, and I was between two other biographers, both of whom were quite concerned about the fact that while they knew what someone did at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Tuesday of such and such a year, and 3 o'clock in the afternoon of the Wednesday of such and such a year, they didn't know what that person was doing at midnight. And I was just, hello. You know, that wasn't what concerned me. What concerned me was, maybe this is my training as a psychologist, because I was a psychologist before I became a journalist, but what concerns me far more is the dynamic of someone's life, the things that impinge on them, the things that influence them, what I know she must have seen. I know she must have seen mass crucifixions. The little village of Nazareth, for instance, was just over the hill, just over the ridge from a major garrison town where there were crucifixions by the hundreds. And certainly she saw them, maybe even with her son in her arms, watching as rebels against Roman occupation were crucified by the Roman forces. And, I mean, maybe even some of her own kinspeople were crucified. There are only 200 or 300 people in this village. It's almost certain that some of her kinspeople were among those being crucified. Another thing that I've done, for instance, is... And this I didn't know at the beginning. It sort of occurred to me as I was reading again the New Testament and looking at some of the things that Jesus does, where he bends down, for instance, picks up some clay from the ground, mixes it with spit, and puts the paste on the blind man's eye, and the blind man can see again. Right? Now, there is a certain kind of clay in that part of the world, a certain kind of yellow kaolin clay that traditional peasant women still go out to collect, dry, pound to a powder, and keep at home for two purposes. One is to stop grapes from fermenting for grape syrup, which they use like we use maple syrup. And the other is to put in compresses to draw out infection.
Hmm.
And this is what some people call folk healing, others call traditional healing. But this is the healing that took place in villages all over the world for thousands of years. And in fact, if you read carefully the great Greek and Roman physicians, they all say that all their medicines come from the knowledge of the village healers, who were always, nearly always, women. They were called wise women. And if there were 200 people, say, in Nazareth, or even 250, we can assume that maybe 50 of those were adult women. And began to make sense to me that where Jesus learned both the art and the science of healing, both physical healing and faith healing, was not in Egypt or in China or in India or any of the other exotic places people send him to in their sort of rather exotic fantasies. But the one place that's most logical, he learned it at home. He learned it from his mother. Mariam was a healer and a midwife, and she taught her son, in the lack of a daughter, or at least a daughter who survived to adulthood, everything she knew.
That's interesting. You have so many interesting things that you've uncovered with this book. It's quite fascinating, actually. We have another minute left, and I wanted to ask you about research. How do you know when it's time to stop researching and start writing, or do you write and research concurrently?
Yes, I do them both together. I take notes as I go along, and I sort of fool myself by saying, well, they're just notes. But some, you know, it's notes in a book, but then I start sort of, without even quite realizing it, writing more and more and more, and it turns out to be me writing rather than the person whose notes I'm taking. So, you know, I sort of start off with a quote or two from a book and find myself commenting on them, and then I take off without quite realizing it. So I stopped when I had about a 250,000 words of notes. I realized it was probably time to stop and look through what I had and see if I could find those strands that would weave together into a story, and which truly was an act of faith on my part, because I didn't know for sure if they were there, and they were.
Hmm. Wow. Any last words, Leslie, for writers listening that are interested in writing biography, or that are struggling with one?
I would say, don't be afraid to imagine. I mean, all of history is an act of recreation, of imagining. And in fact, you know, there's a whole school of new historians who say exactly this. There is no absolute truth to history. It is always a reinterpretation, looking at new facts, bringing in new things. And the wider the field from which you can bring them in, the better, the more feeds in there. So I would say, absolutely, don't be afraid to imagine. But don't think that this does not mean that you do not have to do the research.
Right.
Research as widely and as deeply as you possibly can, and then see how it all merges together in your own mind.
Mm.
And remember that, you know, we pick our subjects for a reason. We're always involved with our subjects, hopefully, if it's a good biography. I can't imagine anyone writing a good biography who is not, one way or another, deeply involved for personal reasons with their subject.
Yes. Hmm. Well, you've given us a wonderful book, and I certainly thank you for that.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. That was Leslie Hazelton, author of Mary, a Flesh and Blood Biography of the Virgin Mother, published by Bloomsbury. Also with an intriguing cover. You know, you who listen to this show often know that I always talk about covers, and this one is very intriguing, as well as the book, of course. And Leslie Hazelton was speaking to us from her houseboat in Seattle. Do stay tuned. We will be back in a few minutes with Janice Hallowell, author of The Annunciation of Francesca Dunn. Don't go away.
Come back, baby. don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. One's better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We've been here since 5 o'clock, and we are back now with Janice Halliwell, author of The Annunciation of Francesca Dunn. Janice has been a potter and a graphic designer. She was awarded an associateship by the Rocky Mountain Women's Institute to write The Annunciation of Francesca Dunn, published by William Morrow. She lives in Boulder, Colorado, with her husband and daughter. Hi, Janice.
Hi, Barbara. How are you?
Great. Great to have you on.
Thank you.
I'm trying to remember when I came in contact with this book, The Annunciation of Francesca Dunn. Perhaps I read about it in a magazine. Maybe it was Organic Style. There was a little review somewhere, and I was so intrigued. I just had to find you. I just love this book. The writing was so wonderful, and your premise, I thought, was really fresh and different. And I wonder if you would talk a bit about how the book came about.
Oh, sure. Well, thank you. And thank you for reading it and looking for it in, I'm not sure what magazine you might have seen it in, but the premise. Well, it's basically a story about belief and in some ways a cautionary tale about the folly of belief, but primarily just about the various things the different people in the book will do to believe in their own salvation, whatever form that might take for them.
So then, I mean, you have the idea, and how does it find its way then into these characters? You have a few point of view characters, you know, in different, you know, first person, third person. How did that take form? How did it go from concept to, you know, on the page?
Yeah. Well, I knew that I wanted to make this story about belief, and because I wanted to set it in modern-day America, I figured it would probably be good to have the Judeo-Christian myth be involved. And although I am not particularly Christian, and this is not a Christian writing, I wanted to work with that because I think that's kind of at the root of our society. The book was based, in part, on a movie by Satyajit Ray, an Indian filmmaker,
mm-hmm.
who made a movie called Devi in 1960, which is a similar story, but it's set in Hindu India of the 1920s, and the patriarch believes that his daughter-in-law is an incarnation of the goddess Kali. So the modern-day version of that in this country would be an annunciation of a young girl. And so Francesca Dunn is that young girl. And then, because she is a young and impressionable teenager, I wanted to have the projections by all the people around her be clarified in the book. And so I had the idea of writing it from their points of view. So there are three points of view that sort of circle around Francesca at the center in the first person. And then Francesca herself, there are chapters that are entitled Francesca, but they're not set in first person. They're told in the close third person, which is just, you know, just a really close third person, kind of situated above her head and behind her, sort of a soul voice, ageless, non-judgmental voice telling her parts of the story.
Interesting. Do you relate more to any one of the characters than the others?
Oh, you know, they're all me on some level. But, you know, Chester's really the lifeblood. He is the one that kind of carried the book for me all the way through. And so if I have to pick amongst my children, I guess I would say that Chester's the favorite.
Oh, well, gosh, it's a lovely book, and I would love it if you would read to us.
Oh, okay.
And if you just tuned in, yeah, it's a little bit late here, but you still have time. I'm talking with Janice Halliwell, author of The Annunciation of Francesca Dunn, published by William Morrow. Okay?
Okay, this is the first chapter of the book, and it is in Chester's voice, and he says this. People who live in houses never get it, but street people know. Fall begins on the 15th of August, at the exact moment when summer's at its peak. It happens like breath, the exhale being the seed of the inhale. There's the first yellow leaf. A tiredness comes over the green. The smell of snow rolls down from the mountain, and your bones remember the cold that's coming. It was that night, the night summer slipped into fall, that she became the virgin. Before, she was just a girl who worked at Ronnie's Cafe on weekends, handing out free food after hours. There had never been anything about her to suggest divinity. No traces of roses lingered around her. There was no holy brightness, but all of that changed with the season. That night, as always, I waited until dark to look for a place to sleep. There was a spot in the bushes by the river that I often used, and after I smoothed the dirt with my hand, I gingerly pulled my sleeping bag from its sack, trying to keep the goose down from leaking out of the many small rips in the fabric. I checked to make sure I wasn't visible from the road. You see, when the season changes, it brings the college boys back to town. They come, all suburbs and sex, looking to show their frat boy friends how to kick bums trapped in sleeping bags. They never got me, though. I knew their ways from teaching them long before, and from being one of them before that. I sat and ate my supper, a splendid ripe tomato pinched from a backyard garden. With the tip of my knife, I saluted my unknowing benefactors. They have the white picket fence and cozy kitchen. When the tomato was gone, I put away my knife, wiped the juice out of my beard, and turned up the collar on my coat. I didn't take off my boots. As much as I hated the dirt going into my bag, boots tended to disappear if they're not on you, and boots can make the difference between staying alive and not. I had settled in, hoping for sleep, when there was a commotion above the water. I opened my eyes, and she was there. She was a vision, a visitation, a sighting, a hallucination, all words for the same thing, the moment that imprinted itself on all the remaining moments of my life. She hovered over the creek, swirled in ambrosial light. The water coursed around her feet, but her dress stayed dry. She held the baby close. Her mouth moved, but I couldn't hear the words. So I made my way to the edge of the water. She was the girl from Ronnie's, only with eyes as deep as the universe and wrapped in a cloak of glory. The smell of roses, the velvety ache of them, lured me in. She smiled at me and said, "Yours will be a magnificent role in the coming of my son." Now, I'm no newcomer to strangeness. I've had it all my life. It's my curse and my blessing that I can smell things other people can't. I can pick up the rotten sweetness of infection from across the street. Anger coming off a person is an acrid, mustardy thing, not unlike the odor of ants, and lying has a cloying, soapy smell that makes my mouth pleat. I'd been smelling things forever, but I had never had a visitation before, and this was the real deal, complete with singing angels and rapturous awe. I knew instantly who she was. I hadn't been to church since I was a little boy, but I knew. I recognized her by the roses and by the blue of her robe, and before I realized what was happening, she reached between my ribs and took my heart in her hand. It settled there like a tame rat, trembling at her touch. I don't know how long she was with me, but when I came back to myself, I was waist deep in the water and she was gone. And I knew that this was what I was supposed to do, find her in the flesh and serve her.
Thank you very much. That was Janice Hallowell reading from the beginning of The Annunciation of Francesca Dunn, published by William Morrow. Well, I'm curious about Chester and if this first chapter was always the way the book began. Was he the first character that came to you?
He was. I always knew that it would be about a teenage girl, but I wanted to tell the story from the people around her, so Chester was the first one that came up. And his voice started the book. This book is unlike anything else I've ever written in that it kind of came, you know, from front to back. First chapter came first, and after that they just marched along.
Really?
Yeah, it's never happened before or since, unfortunately.
What do you attribute that to?
You know, it just seemed like... This book has always felt to me like, as long as I can just hold on tight and stay with it, it would just pull me through the story and be what it needed to be.
Hmm.
I had that sense going all the way along with it.
Interesting. Now, Chester sounds very authentic, and so many of his perceptions and madness, actually, sound like things I would imagine homeless people would go through.
Hmm.
How did you know this? Was that a part of your research, or I mean, did you just imagine what a character like him might be dealing with?
Most of it was just imagined. You know, I live in Boulder, Colorado, and there are quite a few homeless people here, and so I would see them on the streets and give them money, but I didn't do any interviews. I chose to imagine it sort of from the inside out, and. Somehow or other, I came up with this idea about him being able to smell things, like the emotions and the illness and the pain in people. And then, after I wrote the book and had it all checked out by a psychiatrist friend, you know, just to make sure that the medicine in it was correct and all of that, he said that, in fact, it's a pretty common symptom of schizophrenia, these olfactory hallucinations.
Really?
Yeah.
And you didn't know that?
I didn't.
I love it when that happens.
I thought I was making it up.
That's great. Well, I'm also curious about the length of time. 6 years is a long time.
Yeah.
To write a book. What sustained you over that period of time where you just had to stay with it and finish it and see it to the end?
Yeah, you know, the book really did sustain me. I was writing while also raising a small child. And so I didn't write every day at that time. I took 6 months off several different times and then got back to the book. And every time I got back to it because it just kept calling to me and wanted me to come back and finish. So
sure.
I did.
How do you know when it's working? And how do you know when it's not working? Were there sections you threw out because of what they weren't working?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So how do you know? What is it that tells you? Is it something intuitive? Is it having a reader that...
Well, sometimes it's your editor that tells you. This isn't working. but just when it's yourself writing, for me, this story was very story-driven, you know, very plot-driven. And when something didn't work with the overall structure of the story, then I knew I had to get rid of it no matter how much I liked the writing. It could be this beautiful little piece that I loved the writing, but if it didn't quite work and make the story go forward, I had to dump it.
Well, speaking of plot, did you work that out? Did you know pretty much where you were going?
Well, you know, I always outline things, and I outlined this... very intricately on cards, and they were all over the wall for years. And then I began writing, and I would start writing the book. And then I'd get to a point where I realized that I had written myself away from the cards. And so then I would rework the cards. And then I'd, keep going. And I did that over and over. I probably did 20 drafts.
You interesting.
That way, you know, where I'd rework the plot, and then I'd write as much as I could, and then I'd rework the plot some more, and then write what I knew from that.
It was so the plot was somewhat liquid.
Yeah. Originally, I had a very different ending in mind.
How was it ending? What was the original ending? Without giving away the current one.
Originally, I had thought that Francesco would commit suicide at the end, which is one of the reasons why I had her speak in the third person, kind of a removed soul voice.
Yeah.
It almost seemed like it was from beyond the grave. But then it just wasn't working, and I realized that, no, in fact, she wasn't going to die, that that sacrifice would be made by somebody else, and that she would just be... I don't want to give it all away here.
No, don't give it away.
She would go on. She would keep living.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting. At what point did that change? That where you knew that it just couldn't end like that? Were you through a few drafts, or were you halfway through?
I'd done a couple of drafts. And but it changed pretty quickly, you know, pretty early on in the process. Hmm. Maybe a couple years into it.
Early on, a couple years into it, it changed. Oh, that's funny. So all of you out there who are working on a novel, you know, and it's been a year, it's nothing. Keep going.
It is nothing. It's such a big, unwieldy thing. And that's what's so great about a novel.
Yeah.
It's how big and unwieldy it is.
Yes. That's true. I mean, it's such a different process than from writing a short story, say, or certainly...
Short stories scare me to death. I don't write short stories.
Really?
Yeah.
What scares you about them?
Because every word has to carry so much weight, and they have to be so succinct and to the point. With a novel, you can, you know, you wander for quite a while, and you can go down side roads, and you can come back again. But with a short story, you know, you have to just be on it, just crystal clear every single second. I have tremendous respect for short story writers.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a dense form.
Yeah.
Yeah. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here with Janice Hallowell, author of The Annunciation of Francesca Dunn. I always talk about covers on this show. I'm sure listeners who've been listening for years are just so sick of hearing me discuss covers, but this cover is just so beautiful. The colors and the design. Was this the original cover?
Yeah, I actually designed the cover.
Really?
Yeah, my name is not on it because I didn't want to have a credit on there, so they put the name of the typographer as the designer. But I was told by my wonderful editor at William Morrow that I could have input on the cover, but being a first time writer, I couldn't have veto power or anything like that. But I could have input. So the day came and she called me and said, "If you want input, do it today." And I just, having been a graphic designer in the past, I made a little sketch of what I'd been thinking of and faxed it off to them, and it turns out they really liked it. And then they just went with it, and I got to talk to the photographer, who's a woman from San Francisco, and the art director in New York, and, you know, they took the ball and ran with it, but it was originally my idea. Mm. And there were some other additions to it, too. My editor suggested the rose.
The rose is such a nice touch.
Yeah. So it was really a great kind of a combination.
Also, the blue toenail polish, I think, is very cool. You know, it's just, it all works. It all works. The colors and design. Yeah, it's a great cover. I wonder if we could talk for a few minutes on sort of the business of selling this book.
Yeah, sure.
Finding an agent, selling it. Was that all pretty easy? And did you write the whole book before you tried to get an agent?
Well, first, getting an agent was never easy for me. God, no. And I had been writing for 6 years before I started writing this book. I'd written another novel that I wrote a bunch of different ways, and had a couple of different agents on that. Never did sell it. And then when I finally abandoned that and wrote Francesca Dunn, yeah, I waited until I was all finished, and then I looked for agents again. And since I'd already done it a couple of times before, I'd already learned a couple of things. But it always seems like you learn the next thing you need to learn, you know, in the process when you face it. So I, this time I was really lucky. I had been to a writer's conference in Aspen, and I had met two or three agents there who were all interested in the book at once, plus another agent in New York. They were all New York agents, but another one on, you know, from another source. So I had like four agents who were really interested in representing the book, and that was, for me, unheard of after all those years of trying to get an agent. And suddenly a whole bunch of really good ones wanted it. So I went to New York and I tried to do the sensible thing and, you know, had a meeting with each and every one of them and tried to make the decision and made my pick. And she started to market it to editors, and then she became very ill and had to leave the country and go home to Denmark for treatment. So there I was with the book circulating, it suddenly stopped, and I didn't have an agent. So I did the thing that you're never supposed to do. Michael Peach at Little Brown had been really interested in it, but they had ultimately passed because I guess other people on the committee didn't want the novel, but he did. And I knew this, and then my agent, you know, had to quit, and I was stuck, so I called him up. And this is not what you're supposed to try at home, folks. But I did because I was desperate, and I figured I didn't have an agent anyway, and what the hell, they'd already rejected it. So I called him up, and I called him late at night, thinking I'd get his voicemail so that it would be polite for him to reject me with, you know, without losing face in any way. He actually answered his phone. And it was like 11 o'clock at night in New York and 9 o'clock here in Colorado. And I said, so, you know, first of all, I don't have an agent anymore. Why didn't you take the book? And, you know, what in the world am I going to do? And we had a nice talk about it, and he gave me a list of agents that I should try. And my agent, Kathy Anderson, that's Anderson Grinberg, Literary Associates, was at the top of the list, and it was the only one that didn't have an address, so I couldn't query her. All I had was a phone number. So I queried all the others, and I called her because I only had a phone number. And because I only had a phone number, she got to see the book first because she picked up her phone. And then so she wanted to represent it, and I liked her, and that was how that happened. But it wasn't without going through, you know, a whole lot of trauma with all these other agents.
And then selling it, how did that go?
It took about a year and a half.
Really?
Yeah, it took a while. And my agent was sure that it would take a while because she wanted to make sure it was the right fit. And because it's not, you know, it's hard to sell a first novel, as everybody who writes knows. We all hear, oh, nobody's buying novels, and first novels are really hard to sell, and all of that. Anyway, it took her a while, but then this deal with William Morrow came through, and it was worth waiting for.
I bet.
Yeah, I really like my editor, and it's a great house, and they've been really good to me, so I'm glad that it happened that way.
You know, and everything you're saying, I keep thinking of one word that you have that is a difficult thing for writers, and that is patience. You know, to just have that ability to keep working and waiting, and trusting that it's all happening the way it's supposed to be happening, instead of, you know, getting mired in, you know, depressing, awful thoughts.
Well, I think it probably, if you talk to my husband and other people who know me, like, for instance, the day I buried my first novel in the backyard, they probably wouldn't have said that trusting and patient was exactly my forte. But tenacious, definitely. And I just learned that it just felt like I had no choice. I had to just hang on and keep going. And eventually it worked out.
Hmm.
And so, yeah.
Now, did you start working on something else during that year and a half while she was selling it, just feeling like, this is going to sell, now I can go on to the next project?
No, I didn't. I didn't work during that period. I was making pottery then, and I just sort of took a break from the writing while it was, you know, I wasn't sure it was going to sell. In fact, I was pretty sure it was never going to sell, and I was really in the process of getting myself organized to quit writing altogether and to grow my pottery business into a small manufacturing
really?
company. Yeah, and it's actually kind of a funny story. I went to Utah for a yoga retreat, thinking, you know, I'm going to take this week to really, you know, get in tune with myself and make it okay to quit writing and to figure that, you know, it just wasn't meant to be. I'm going to just let it go. And while I was there, you know, various people there said, you know, don't quit. Just stay in the game. Just keep going. And I thought, okay, well, it was Labor Day weekend when I came back from the retreat, and I called my agent and I said, you know, I'm about ready to quit, but, you know, if you want to give it one more try. And she said, don't quit. And 2 weeks later, I got the call. But I was really, you know, I was pulling up stakes. I really was, because it was just too hard to keep trying after. That was 12 years at that point.
Yeah. My goodness. Well, I'm glad you didn't quit. I'm glad she sold it. But it is interesting, and I think it's probably a good thing, you know, for writers to have something else, another art form that is interesting, you know, that it's not, you know, totally always writing, that there's something else that's at least interesting to you.
I agree. I think that's definitely true.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Any last words? We're at the end of our time. Any last words to writers listening who may be running out of patience at this point or who are struggling through a project?
I would just say hang on, you know. Everything that you've ever done in your life, I bet you everybody has said, oh, that's difficult to do, not very many people make it. But somebody has to make it, and I think that it's just a matter of finding the right fit at the right time. Yeah. And if you can last it out and just keep perfecting your work, then you know, it'll happen. And at least, at the very least, you will have done something very worthwhile.
Yes, exactly. Well, thank you so much, and continued good luck with this book. You've been getting wonderful reviews today in USA Today, a wonderful review. You just got one in the Boston Globe. You're all over the place, and I'm just so happy to see that happening with this book.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. That was Janice Hallowell, author of The Annunciation of Francesca Dunn, speaking to us from Boulder, Colorado. All right, and we're at the end of another hour. Just sped by. If you'd like to know more about Writers on Writing, you can visit my website at writersonwriting.com. And I want to leave you with a quote from the beginning, actually, of The Annunciation of Francesca Dunn. And it's by a 16th century Hindu mystic, and it goes something like this: only those who have felt the knife can understand the wound. Only the jeweler knows the nature of the jewel. Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week.